This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Obviously, we're living in very different times at the moment, and what we normally do with the podcast is take components of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland Out of Doors and then rejig it and turn it into a podcast. There is so much coming in at the moment in the way of comments, texts, emails, etc., and there's some lovely stuff in there. It seems daft not to include it. So, this is what we got up to this week.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
That was the sound of our senior producer, Helen Needham, arriving this morning. Every time she steps out of the car, that sound happens. It's astonishing. We've got thunder and lightning, so if this programme disappears, I'm not joking here, if this programme disappears, it is because we have lost power. It's dipped a couple of times across the last hour, and it is teeming rain at the moment. I'm Mark Stephen, sheltering as best I can. With me this morning, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, well, listen to this.
I heard it.
It is teeming down. A big flash of lightning across the sky. I mean, it's possibly monsoon weather here. Here comes. Wow, I don't think I've ever done a live broadcast in this kind of situation for a very long time. Yeah, here we are, the end of June. Thunder, lightning, pouring rain, happy days. But we would like to hear from you if you're in the middle of a storm or whatever. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, and there's loads of stuff on Facebook.
I'm sure there's absolutely nothing to worry about here, because we're both, I mean, what could go wrong? We're both standing outside with big copper cables running up to our heads. Our audio engineer...
Exactly.
Well, our audio engineer, Ron, here, was trying to get me to fly a kite with a key unit for some reason. He mentioned Benjamin Franklin. I didn't quite follow it, to be honest. This weekend sees the climax of National Picnic Week. We get some picnics, do's and don'ts from the foodie Quine Claire Jessamine. Plus, this weekend is also the end of National Insect Week. Full marks to whoever planned those two to coincide. So to celebrate, after I gave them a hard time the other week, we find out what's good about the midgie.
But first, back by popular demand, is the mystery bird. Can you identify which bird makes this really kind of harsh sound?
Sound, that's kind of a prehistoric sound.
Yeah, well, if you do know what that is, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Now, at times, McElraith and I share similar passions. We both love steam trains, guddling about in rock pools, and bizarrely, we both really like buildings made of corrugated iron. We will actively seek out buildings made of this stuff, and it turns out, I've been looking into this, corrugated iron is an extremely versatile material.
We used to have a neighbour, Alec Hay, who was a foreman on a building site.
And he came into the office one time and somebody said to him, Alec, can you make sense of this? He says, it's an order, but and the guy's waiting outside for it, but we can't make sense of it and we're kind of embarrassed to ask. And he looked at it and it was a handwritten note, very badly done, and it looked like code. There was a 1 and a 2 and then the letters RIGLITIN. And he smiled and he says, aye, he says, that guy's after 12 sheets of corrugated iron. 12 wriggly tin. This stuff. I'm standing outside the White Rashes Village Hall. It's our local community hall. And I've been involved with this place for years. And the walls are sheeted in corrugated iron and it's roofed in corrugated iron. It's how it was built. This place is going to be 100 years old very soon. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if at least some of these sheets weren't original. It started off with the wee building at the front, which apparently was a library for the community. And then over the years, the community have extended it further and further and further back. So what you end up with is a building that's actually much longer than it is wide at the front. It's a bit like the TARDIS. If you looked at this thing from above, it'd be a bit like a croquet mallet. But it's all sheeted in corrugated iron, which was patented first in 1828 by a guy called Henry Palmer. Now, Henry Palmer's idea was really simple. Take a flat sheet of steel, run it through shaped rollers so that you corrugate it. The word comes from the Latin ruga, apparently. It means wrinkled. And then you rust-proof each sheet by dipping it in molten zinc. What you end up with is a highly versatile building material that's light. You can transport it very easily. It's inexpensive, it's long-lasting, and very weather-resistant. Corrugated iron made an appearance at the Great Exhibition in London in 1851, where it impressed Prince Albert. He ended up ordering a corrugated iron ballroom for Balmoral. It was supposed to be 24 feet wide, 60 feet long, and 17 feet high. Between him seeing it and ordering it, they delivered it up to Balmoral. They built it in Balmoral and it was ready for the Gillies Ball less than 3 months later. The total price for it was £194. Incredibly, it's still on the go. Apparently the estate carpenter uses it as a workshop nowadays. That portability of corrugated iron was really key to its success. You could stick it on a boat, a train, a horse and cart. Clyde Puffers took mountains of the stuff up and down the West Coast, and you could build more or less anything with it. I've seen a catalogue from Braby & Co., based in Springburn in Glasgow, advertising corrugated iron buildings as suitable for habitation, public meeting, warehousing, manufacturing and divine worship. The latter was particularly popular. Spears of Glasgow, another company, built 75 corrugated iron churches for the United Free Church. Loch Fyneside Church in Menard is made of Wrigley tin, as is the Church of Our Lady of Mercy in Aberfeldy, and the wonderfully called Grouse Chapel in Killin, built by the 7th Marquess of Breadalbane so that his shooting guests would have somewhere to worship of a Sunday. Prefabricated corrugated iron buildings from Scotland were sent all around the world. We sent buildings to the California Gold Rush, the goldfields of Australia, and the diamond mines of South Africa. Why? Well, because they were cheap, they were portable, and just about any idiot could put them up. They were used as churches, gyms, hunting lodges, billiard rooms, laundries, schools, hospitals, farm buildings, even barracks. Nissen huts, if you think about it, named after their Canadian designer, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Nissen, were made of corrugated iron. 100,000 of them by the end of the Great War. The French car manufacturer, Citroën, actually produced a corrugated iron truck, and not to be outdone, the Germans built a corrugated iron plane, the Junkers J1, and it flew. There are a lot of buildings in Scotland that still have corrugated iron roofs. I actually passed one this morning. I was out on my bike and I was taking a route I've never taken before. And in a field off to my right, I saw this building. Now, there's not even a track to it anymore. It's a ruin. It's a classic button bin. So, single story, door in the middle, window either side. And it's built of field stones. But the roof was just bright orange. It was rusty corrugated iron, and it really jumped out. It stuck out from all that green around it. The reason that tin roofs were so popular is that very often tenants needed what straw they had for cattle fodder. There was none to spare to actually thatch their roofs. And they weren't allowed by the landlords to collect rushes or pool heather for thatching. So corrugated iron was a cheap solution to the misery of a leaky roof. And you can still find examples of where the corrugated iron was laid on top of the old thatch. Just go inside the house and look up, and there it is, basically. Next time you get the chance, have a look at how Wrigley tin roofs rust. In the old days, the zinc coating wasn't always entirely even, which is why each sheet of corrugated iron rusts in different ways. Essentially, it's an ongoing artwork. It's a collaboration between time, weather, and chemistry. And in really old stuff, the ends rust through. It happens sometimes with corrugated iron beside the sea, and you end up with something that looks like filigree or lace. It can be really beautiful. So you can see corrugated iron buildings, like the White Rush's tin hut, just about anywhere, and yet officially, they're pretty well invisible. There are over 40,000 listed buildings in Scotland, of which just 12, a dozen, are corrugated iron structures, and I think that's a real shame. I'm actually thinking of setting up an organisation which will be for the over 50s, for ageing aficionados of corrugated iron. I'm going to call it Wrinkley's for Wrigley Tin. Join now and I'll send you a corrugated iron badge. Well, I won't, but I'd like to. There is a beauty in corrugated iron, but not everybody sees it.
It's lovely. It's lovely. It's one of the great sights in the Scottish countryside, is when the corrugated iron has gone. And it's that lovely colour of rusted bracken. It really stands out. Apologies for the noise of the rain here. It really is monsoon, and we're getting serious thunder and lightning.
There's torrential rain here too in Aberdeen. I have put the fire on as usual, not because it's particularly cold, because it's not, but because we usually cook on it. We cook the bacon on it later, which is fine. But I'm trying to keep the rain off the fire. There's a wee bit of a sort of portico bit here at the front of the BBC, but it's smoking, and it suddenly crossed my mind that there's a fair chance it's going to melt the automatic door opening system.
It all goes badly wrong today.
What do we do?
I think the mystery bird's really taken off. I thought it was going to be really hard, but seems to be an awful lot of clever people out there. There's quite a lot of them actually saying the bird I did think about putting on this, but Ian and Strathpepper. He said it. Are we going to say what he said it was?
No, I would say Ruth and Murray said it was exactly the same thing. Right now, the emails are coming in 50-50. Half of them have got it right, half of them got it wrong, and we're just going to tease you. We're going to keep it going a little longer, not tell you either way.
Yeah, if you've got a favourite corrugated iron building, then get in touch. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. When we did the North Coast 500, I took a wee camera with me, and I made a little video, which I'll try and dig out, of corrugated iron building. Goodness me.
That full
sky just lit up, so we should get a big bow. I've been counting it. It's about, here we go.
Oh, yeah, beauty. See, I love storms. I absolutely love storms. I think they're fabulous things.
I love it until you get right underneath it and you get that pressure wave from the thunder. Yeah. And, you know, and the dog goes to the furthest room in the house. There's another flash of lightning that's really kicking off here.
Our lockdown exercise piece this week comes from fellow broadcaster Nicola Meehan. Nicola is the presenter of the Friday afternoon show here on BBC Radio Scotland. So accompanied by her husband John, Nicola went for a wander on her home patch near Stirling.
Now we have come up the Abbey Craig via Causewayhead Park, but we have stopped to catch our breath because there's quite a few stairs on the way up there,
isn't
there?
There's quite a lot of stairs. I'd never been up that way before, and I can see the reason why that's true.
It absolutely blows my mind that in the... How many years have I known you? 14, 15, 16, 17, 18? I think it's about that. Closer to 20.
Yeah.
I've never taken you up that way.
No.
It's very interesting. So I grew up in Causewayhead, which is the village at the foot of the Wallace Monument. And I have no idea how many times I have climbed those steps. Always exhausting. I know, it was absolutely worth it. Now, I'm not talking about the steps in the actual Wallace Monument. Just talking about the old crumbly steps that take us into this utterly gorgeous woodland, the Abbey Craig. Now, at this juncture, I'm going to say something about the way we walk.
Okay.
So we both walk daily.
Yeah.
We have been walking throughout lockdown.
We have.
And it's occurred to me that we walk in very different ways.
In what sense?
I'm a very sort of passive walker, okay?
Right.
I can walk up the hills, or I'll walk up the Abbey Craig, and I live in my memories, or I listen to music, and I daydream.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're paying attention to nature. You're an archaeologist, so you're reading the landscape. And tell me what you've been doing with birds of the flying kind over lockdown.
Well, I realised I was seeing an awful lot more species than I would normally see on my daily jaunt. So I decided that I would actually start logging what I was seeing and create a spreadsheet because I'm an archaeologist.
Everything needs to be recorded.
Everything needs to be recorded, yeah.
So how many species of birds have you seen in the wider kind of Stirling, so Causeway Head, Bridge of Allen area, over the last 3 months?
I think there's a possible total of something like 104, 105 species that are known to be in this area this time of year. I haven't seen that many. But I'm into the low 60s now, so I've seen quite a few.
And counting. Who knows what we'll see today. Now, the Abbey Craig has been interesting over lockdown. I've spoken to quite a few people, friends, who have been up here, and have come very, very close to deer and animals that would otherwise maybe usually be a little bit more shy. But it's much quieter up here at the moment. This is usually a huge tourist attraction, busloads of tourists up to the monument itself.
Yep.
But what other animals would we see? This is where I get passive again. I ask you questions. What kind of a bird is that? That's lovely. And then go off in a reverie about, oh, I remember when... Uh-huh. Well, we got married
when
up
I was
here
a
as
kid.
Well.
We did get married up here.
Just remembered that, for example. What birds might we see up the Abbey Craig or here?
As we were talking there, we just went past a pair of bullfinches, which was very nice to see. And we'll probably see lots of kind of woodland birds because we're surrounded by woodland here.
We are indeed. So we're kind of, as you can probably hear by our breathing, we're still walking uphill. We're going to keep wandering. We're going to go up to the kind of top of the Abbey Craig, so on which the Wallace Monument is perched. There's some brilliant cliffs up there. I used to recreate Bon Jovi's Blaze of Glory video on those. Less said about that, the better. Thank goodness it's before the days of camera phones.
Yeah.
But also it has some stunning views. We've just made it to the top. What's that I can hear?
A bird.
The science is meticulous.
I know. Unfortunately, bird song's not one of my strong suites.
You've also dragged me gently over to a rock formation, which you've been marvelling at.
Well, we are literally on the top of a volcanic plug, and as you can see, you've got these sort of large, very large rocks, way taller than me, rocks on end, sticking out of the ground.
It's like a kind of craggy Mount Rushmore vibe we've got going on.
It really is, and I'm seriously wondering how it's managed to be created in such a form naturally. Mm-hmm. In other words, it might not be natural, it might be man-made,
okay,
deposited, or human-made deposited.
I'll take a
structures.
Picture. I'll take a picture. We'll study it later. Right, let's go along to the, to not so much the summit, but just along from the sort of platform on which the Wallace Monument stands. It's one of my favourite views. Probably my favourite view, actually, in the entire world. And as you know, I lived in London for years, and I was hugely homesick the whole time that I was there, which is why I eventually moved home. And if I could put into words the thing that made me unhappy the most about being there, that doesn't sound too melodramatic, it's that I couldn't see any distance. I could not see in front of me. There were buildings and people everywhere. And every Saturday, if I wasn't somewhere in the world touring with some rock and roll band or other, I'd get the first train up from London. I'd been Stirling by about 11:30, And by 12 o'clock, before I'd seen anyone or done anything else, I'd be right here. I've just arrived at it. There's even a little bench.
It's an amazing view too.
It's an absolutely glorious view. We're almost directly opposite the castle.
Yep.
And in between, I suppose we have something that's hugely picturesque, but also I guess it's what it means to people as well. I can see my primary school, Riverside. I can see where my old high school was, Wallace High.
Yep.
All the houses I ever lived in when I grew up. But also, I can see in front of me. What a distance. We haven't seen any deer yet, so I'm going to suggest we go and do that next. And we also haven't seen Mad Manaha.
No, I think we should go and look for both.
Mad Manaha is the legend, the legendary kind of ghost stroke warlock that was rumoured to roam the Abbey Craig. I think I once saw him. He had a monk's cowl on. There was a little hut up here, you see, and that was supposed to be Mad Manaha's hut. So seeing as
I think it's been removed, yeah?
It has been removed, but he's still here.
Right, okay.
Nicola, me and her husband John at Abbey Craig near Stirling. And you can catch Nicola on air on Friday afternoons on BBC Radio Scotland from 1:30 onwards. You can hear the rain in the background there. There is torrential rain here in Aberdeen. There's torrential rain up in Bamford, Ewenis. With somebody coming in saying, no more thunder, please. It's setting the dogs off. But listen, we're not playing this in. It's not effects. It's actually happening. He says there's blue skies in Malig. Carol says there's thunder and lightning in Switzerland at the moment. Who knew? It's obviously a very, very big storm. Sue and Stephen Strathorn says, great start to the programme. Send some storm this way, please. Love a bit of thunder and a picnic. Although not necessarily simultaneously.
Loads and loads and loads of you are getting this bird right. I honestly thought when I put this together that very few folk would get it. But here's another wee clip.
It's a great sound, that. Connor in Slimbridge says, ah, the mystery bird. I reckon it's a dinosaur dressed up as an old man hunched over in a greatcoat. I don't know what you're drinking, Connor, but you need to give it up. Just stop it. And in corrugated iron, used to be one in Arran where they showed pictures, apparently, corrugated iron buildings. It was a cinema, and boy, when it rained, you couldn't hear a thing. Also, they were built as roofs in New Zealand, as they were okay in earthquakes, much better than slates, says Barbie Short in Troon. Amazing the stuff that folks know in this programme.
Yeah, was there not a big corrugated iron cinema in Portree?
Oh, I don't know.
No.
Was it Gaelic?
Look.
There was one. I'm sure there was one up in Gaelic.
Look, you.
Possibly. Possibly.
I think we've got another big bang coming up.
No, I know. It's exactly the same.
If you want to put your hands over the dog's ears.
It's getting darker and darker and darker. And there was a flash of light there, but the thunder's not come yet. Interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking about midges. Now, some of you feel that I gave them a bit of a character assassination because, frankly, I couldn't think of a single redeeming feature of them.
Yeah, well, Deb and Mike on Rum said about those midges, we live on Rum and we agree. Luckily, there's usually some kind of breeze and they can't fly against that. And some places are worse than others. You just have to pick your times for certain jobs. Evenings are challenging. Thanks for an interesting programme. Mary was more on the balanced side of the midge. She said, your beautifully balanced feature on the corvids was lovely. So what about the same for the midge? Someone out there must tell you why they exist. And Scott emailed from Norway. Living in Norway, they discovered a life without midges. It's transformative. We thought with all the trees, the midges would be a nightmare. But it's the opposite. We can go and sit outside, go ut te partu, going for a walk. And an entomologist friend has said, in fact, there's no grass. There's nowhere for them to lay their eggs. And the ground's a bit drier. And she wondered if rewilding Scotland, planting more trees, would massively reduce the midge problem. These are very good questions.
These are very good questions. And we've got the very guy who might be able to answer them. We've got Craig McAdam on the line now, conservation director with the charity Bug Life on the line. I mean, that middle point there, Craig. Good morning to you, by the way.
Morning, Mark.
Morning. Have you got thunder and lightning where you are?
No, it's a beautiful day here.
I tell you, it's obviously just us. We've obviously done something to offend somebody. anyway, that middle point, what is the point of midges?
Midges are eaten by birds, they're eaten by bats, amphibians, dragonflies and other insects. The males probably pollinate some plants as well. And they're also caught by insect-eating plants like sundews and butterworts. So they're a really important source of protein for all these sort of animals as well.
I love going to the West Coast, but the one thing that would put me off living there are the midges, and they seem so much worse on the West Coast as opposed to where we live in the East. Is that right?
Yeah, it probably is right. There's somewhere in the region of about 37 species of midge in Scotland. Only a handful of those will bite humans. The rest of them bite birds and cattle and deer and other mammals. They're worse in areas where we've got peaty soils because they're living in those soils. In the areas where you've got sandier soils, they're not as bad.
So if you were to take midges out of the food chain, what impact do you think that would have?
Well, a single bat eats around about 3,000 midges per night. So, I mean, they are incredibly important for other animals. And just imagine how many midges there would be if there weren't bats feeding on them. There's been estimates that in Scotland, the Highland midge, the one that we come into contact most often with because of the biting, there's estimates of that there's 180,000 trillion of those in Scotland.
Ow.
Wow. There's an interesting connection with chocolate, isn't there, that I wasn't aware of?
That's right. So a relative of the Highland midge, the one that bites us, is actually the only pollinator of cocoa. So without midges, we wouldn't have chocolate.
Seriously?
Yep.
It's taking a second to drink that in.
I'm having to think about that, yeah. Listen, we were hoping you might be able to, well, we've got hold of you, we're hoping you might be able to help us here because one of our listeners got in touch with a recording of an insect that he was hoping to identify. Brian Smith emailed in and said, last night my wife and I were walking the Pentlands near Harlaw Reservoir. We heard a noise in the hedgerow like a cricket. I think it was an insect noise. However, it was solitary, which is what puzzled us. Have a listen to this sound. Does that sound like an insect to you?
Well, it does sound like an insect, but I think what that is a grasshopper warbler. So it's a bird that makes the same sound as a cricket.
Yeah. I remember the first time hearing that, I used to cycle in and out along the Forth and Clyde Canal into the BBC in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And there was a stand of reeds there, and the first time I heard it, I thought it was somebody paying out fishing line.
That's exactly what it's like. It's like a fishing reel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Along the canal and in these little wetlands, a wetland bird, and that's exactly where you would hear it.
Yeah. Look, not to be outdone, you've got a challenge for us now too.
I do. I've got a sound for your listeners to try and guess what it is.
That is a great sound, Ewan.
That's a fantastic sound to sing. I was going to say a frog, but lots of people getting the bird right. Maybe you want to get in touch with us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk and tell us what you think of that sound is.
Craig, we'll say cheerio to you just now. Thank you very much for that. That's a fantastic sound. Personally, I have absolutely no idea what it is, but if you can come back and explain that later in the programme, that would be spot on.
I will do. Yep, great.
Coming up, we're going to be reliving one of our less successful appearances in Out of Doors, a picnic in Colliston Beach. Well, I thought it was very, very successful, but nobody else seemed to like what I'd brought. I've been back writing some verse dedicated to one of our favourite picnic foods. Well, your favourite picnic foods. I'm frankly not that terribly interested in them. And, of course, can you identify the mystery bird?
So, if you know what that is, get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, and lots of people getting very excited about corrugated iron.
Gwen Blair came in and said, corrugated iron buildings, whilst working in Norway a few years ago, a photographer was going round to capture them before they fell and to heighten awareness of architectural loss. Many were saved after funds were raised. Also, many were flat-pack houses for returning World War I heroes. Best place to see them is New Zealand. We've lost many over the years in the northeast. Same with train carriages and farmyards. Gwen Blair says, getting a wriggly tin face in this great weather. John Troop in Kuta says, just listen to your programme in Kuta. There's the Heritage Hall, which started its life as an Episcopal church in Ballater. It was then moved to Kuta in 1907 and became the church hall for St. Peter's Parish Church, now in the possession of St. Peter's Heritage Trust and known as the Heritage Hall. Up to COVID-19, was used by a wide range of community groups. Sheila Stewart, talking about the thunder, says, enjoying your thunderstorms from a distance as we had it on Friday night here in Dumfries and Galloway, overlooking Luce Bay towards the Isle of Man. The Irish Sea was illuminated with sheet lightning. And then she goes on to say, I think the bird noise is fledgling crows, as I had some near me that started wanting their parents to feed them from 4 a.m. every morning, very noisy. Great suggestion, Sheila, but actually not the correct answer. And she's also attached a picture of corrugated iron taken on Eriskay whilst in Holly a couple of years ago. It was the contrast between the old cottage and the new bridge that attracted my attention, and says, keep up good work. Tons of comments actually coming in, a whole variety of stuff. And it's genuinely really nice to get it. Thanks very much for that. Now, as I'm sure many of you will know, and you have had this in your diary, we are at the end of National Picnic Week.
Well, the weather has been good, but I'm on holiday next week, and that's the thunder and lightning in the north wind started. But for many of us, the word picnic conjures up images of soggy sandwiches and a good helping of midges. But the thought about picnic foods piqued my interest, so I went off to research one of the most quintessential picnic treats there is. On the face of it, a Scotch egg is a Scotch egg. But go beneath the outside crust of tasty breadcrumbs and you enter a world of claim and counterclaim, myth and romance. The first mention in print of a boiled egg encased in mincemeat occurs in 1809 in an edition of Maria Rundle's A New System of Domestic Cookery. For her, as with most other writers of the time, they were a dinner dish served hot with gravy. Trust me, it gets worse. At that time, they didn't have a breadcrumb layer, although by 1861, Isabella Beaton, the domestic goddess, was on the case and suggested deep frying with an outer layer of breadcrumbs as an option. She still recommended gravy. But the origin of the Scotch egg may go back much further in time. Many folk believe that the egg's origins are in fact rooted in the coastal Yorkshire town of Whitby. Named after the establishment that invented them, William J. Scott and Sons are said to have invented the Scotties. The original eggs were covered in a creamy fish paste rather than sausage meat before being covered in breadcrumbs. The sausage meat replaced the fish when the eggs began to be sold in big food shops, as it was easier to package. Variations of the original fish-covered eggs can still be purchased on the East Yorkshire coast. And you can see the argument. Scots the fishmonger, Scots eggs, Scotch eggs. But there are other pretenders to the throne, with the luxury food supplier Fortnum & Mason claiming to have created the luxury snack in 1738. I say luxury because unlike today, when every hill walker and rambler has access to a Scotch egg, in 1738, they were designed for a much better class of clientele. The rich and the aristocracy, to be consumed en route to the big country houses out of town. Although quite how one ate a Scotch egg on a jolting coach and still retaining one's dignity has never been catalogued. But they were a big hit, and by the time steam trains came along, Fortnum and Mason were there to happily supply the Thomas Cook customers with a trendy snack on the steam excursions of the 1850s. But there are dark suggestions that the chefs at Fortnum and Mason stole the idea from the Indian Raj, where deep-fried kofta or meatballs look suspiciously like a Scotch egg. Or perhaps they just improved upon the idea. Other theories include the process of deep-frying, which is called scorching, scorched eggs. Also, they were apparently very popular in the 18th century with the Scots Guards, who were billeted in London. Scotch eggs, maybe. In the Netherlands and Belgium and in Scotland in the 1800s, they were known as bird's nests, a nest with an egg inside. But if, like me, you take a double take at Scotch eggs with gravy, get this. In the USA, where they're usually served hot with dipping sauces such as ranch dressing, hot tomato sauce, or hot mustard sauce.
And at the Minnesota State Fair, Scotch eggs are served on a stick, like a toffee apple. But however you like them, and whoever invented them, one thing they are not, and that's Scottish.
Ah, I hate that sound. Somebody that's old enough to remember playing NLPs on air, and I just don't like that sound at all. Anyway, if you'd like to hear more of that kind of music, then Gary Innes, Take the Floor, 7 o'clock tonight, Saturday, or for your listen to the repeat, 5 o'clock on Sunday. Toe-tapping stuff.
See, it's quite interesting seeing that stuff at the Minnesota State Fair, where they've got the Scotch egg on a stick.
Ah.
And when I was researching that, I didn't put it in, but there was people doing a 20,000-calorie challenge where they just go from stall to stall to stall, eating deep-fried food. Yeah.
But the body can't absorb 20,000 calories in a day. Surely that would be really harmful.
Don't do it at home anyway.
No, absolutely do not do it at home. It was the history, and fascinating stuff it was too, the history of the Scotch egg there. And because I'm being held effectively artistic hostage here, well, there's another Doric poem coming up about Scotch eggs later in the programme, and here's a wee taster.
Aye, there they were, just like last year, for many years afore. A tray of orange ballys aneath the ice tray door. They were matron's contribution, supposed to be a treat. A biled egg and breadcrumbs and some Guy Chuch sausage meat.
Sounds absolutely appetising to me. Mmm. Plenty of Scotch eggs.
You don't like them?
I'm not keen on them. It's funny, actually, because we had a bit of a picnic yesterday afternoon and there was Scotch eggs at it, and I had half of a Scotch eggs. But, I mean, do you like them?
Yeah, I like them if they're really well done. I actually did try and get some from Fortnum Masons, who claimed to invent them in 1780-odd, but they couldn't get us them, here in time. But if you get it right, and you get the kind of the yolks still quite soft or runny,
they're
a work of art.
Yeah, I think the yolk being soft and runny would be key to me, you know, because I like a runny yolk.
Yeah.
Corrugated iron, we were talking about earlier, and frankly, it's just gone nuts this morning. John and Lewis in Rothy Norman says, our favourite wrinkly tin building is our Anderson shelter, now used as a woodshed, but there just in case. Our neighbours have the most beautiful bothy made of the stuff, panelled in larch inside. Must be about 100 years old. Posh or what? Can we get the badge, please? Seriously, if I had a badge, I would send it to you. Great programme, complete with sound effects. It's not sound effects, it's real. Our dogs don't know where to look since we've got the same storm as you. Thank you. This text came in saying, as a child, our Croft house in Skye had a tin roof. Vivid memory of trying to sleep as rain clattered down. Apparently, I saw this on Twitter yesterday. I think it was Garabost on Lewis. Tremendous hailstones. Hailstones about the size of a £1 coin. That would sound spectacular on a tin roof. Andy in sunny Inverness says, my father as a student worked as a ponyman. This is great, Ewan. Worked as a ponyman gillie in Sutherland. He says there was nights you couldn't sleep as the stags used to come down from the hill and rub their antlers on the corrugated iron bothy they used to live in. That's the sound I want to record.
Oh, no, that's a very, scratchy needle on a record sound, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you'd never get it as a mystery sound. James says, I'm a priest in the Scottish Episcopal Church. One of my churches is St. Columba's in Brora. Right in the A9 is a tin tabernacle made by Spears & Company, which cost £189. St. Columba's had a fire in 2016, but was lovingly repaired and refurbished and opened for worship again in September last year, only to close again temporarily in March due to COVID. Please get in touch if you're going to be heading north and we could show you around. I'd like to see that, James. Thanks very much for that.
I think there's a whole series to be done on corrugated iron.
And this one's came in from... This is from Ian Strathpeffer. Do you not recall a display of iconic corrugated iron at the Sydney Olympics opening ceremony? No. I don't remember that at all. With the good weather over the past wee while and lockdown easing slightly, heaps of us have been enjoying the outdoors more, and obviously... There's no need. I would be preaching to the choir here if I was even to mention it. But, you know, you take the stuff with you and you take your litter home. Simple as that. With public conveniences still closed, though, what are you supposed to do if you're caught short in the outdoors? Joining us now with some hints and tips is Heather Morning, Mountain Safety Advisor with Mountaineering Scotland. Good morning to you, Heather. How are you?
Good morning, boys.
Boys, God bless you.
Boys. Thank you. What a great way to start an interview.
Absolutely, yeah, you can come back. Yeah. Have you got thunder and lightning with you?
No, here in Aviemore, it's dry.
Oh, well, fair enough. Look, I know, you know, toileting's probably not the most appealing thing to be talking about just after 7 o'clock in the morning, but how we all have to go. So how do you do it responsibly?
Well, first of all, I want to know from you boys, what's the proper etiquette for describing going to the toilet or what we produce when we go to the toilet?
Yes, yes, I have a book. I mean, my late mother-in-law used to talk about SH1T, and it's how to SH1T in the woods. But let's for the purposes of Radio Scotland, let's just call it pooing. We'll call it pooing.
We'll go for poo. I like the sound of poo. It's a bit more user-friendly, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the best way to do it then?
So I think there's various aspects to this. One of the things is pollution of watercourses or contamination to humans, and the other aspect of it is just the visual impact. So depending, you know, we all have to go to the loo outdoors sometimes. You know, if you spend enough time outdoors, then inevitably you're going to have to go for your emergency poo. And I think it really depends on where you are. And if you're away from civilization, then obviously it's a lot easier than, for example, you know, on somewhere like Loch Morlick Beach. And I think the big issues are occurring, you know, in places on the fringe of the countryside at the moment, because we just don't have access to cafes and toilets and public conveniences. So if you're somewhere, you know, that's very public and very accessible, and there's going to be lots of other people using that area, then it's a massive issue. And just doing it and leaving it, you know, for someone else to come across, or a kiddie to crawl into, or your dog to roll in it, and I'm sure you guys have experienced mm-hmm. that pleasure, it's just pretty grim, isn't it, for the people who come after you. So I would say, you know, if you get caught short somewhere fairly accessible, then your only option is to, you know, poo in a bag and take it away with you and put it in the bin when you get somewhere that you're able to do that. Out in the wider outdoors, in the great outdoors, out in the hills, I think it's a very different story. And, you know, if you're going on a sort of organised overnight thing and you're planning to camp, and clearly, you know, during that 24-hour period you're going to need to go for a poo, then take a trowel and bury it. That is the recommended way to do it. But we're not all that organised. You know, we're not that organised sometimes, and we do get caught short. And I would say if you're well away from civilization, away from summits, away from tracks, away from bossies and house, then it's quite acceptable to do, you know, what all the other animals do and just go for a poo and leave it for, you know, to dry out and for nature to decompose. What I would say is don't use bog roll. Some of your readers will be horrified at that mm-hmm. statement, but I never take bog roll on the hill, and I always use moss. It's an excellent alternative, particularly when it's a bit damp. A bit of sphagnum or mm-hmm. feather moss or racometrium is way better than a loo roll. And if you're going to use loo roll, then, you know, take it away with you. Put it in a bag and take it away. If you try and burn it, there's been historical incidents of people setting, you know, whole hillsides on fire yeah. trying to do the right thing and burn the loo roll. But if you're somewhere like a boffy, it's super important. You just be respectful of others. Move, you know, 200 metres at least away from the boffy and bury it. There's always a boffy spade in the boffy to do that, because otherwise, you know, we end up like other countries with things like E. coli in the watercourses. And, you know, our drinking supply is contaminated. You know, isn't it lovely that we live in a mountain environment still, that you can just drink water straight out of the burns and it's not a problem?
Do people, they tend to go for privacy rather than kind of engaging brain. But presumably it's obviously really important to not go near a watercourse, you know, just get as far away from it as you can.
Yeah, that's a really good point about, you know, privacy rather than engaged brain. You know, there's certain, like, popular places like Corrie and Snetta, for example, where the only bit of shelter in the whole of the Corrie is one large boulder that you curry in behind, you know, when it's lacking with rain or blowing a gale. And that's the place that someone's chosen to go for a poo. And it's the place you choose to try and, you know, get some food or drink when you're in a, you know, bad weather. So you know, get away from places like that that obviously people are going to use and welcome for a bit of shelter. It's really antisocial to use it to go to the toilet.
It's strange. I mean, you know, that book that I mentioned was written by a guide in America. I mean, she was a whitewater rafting guide, and she said she was astonished at the fact that, you know, when confronted by the great outdoors, an awful lot of her clients simply had no idea physically how to go to the toilet.
Yeah, yeah. And I frequently come across, particularly ladies, actually, who have issues going, you know, just going for a pee outdoors. It's yeah. just completely alien to them, and they won't drink enough and get dehydrated on the hill yeah. as a consequence of that, because they don't want to go for a pee, which seems bizarre to me. But I guess, you know, I've been brought up running around the fields and the moors and things, and it's just normal. And the whole toilet roll thing is a huge issue, isn't it? You know, you see when you go on, you know, local walks in the woods and things, you know, every little nook and cranny has a wee bit of bog roll stuck in it, where probably ladies, you know, I don't want to be sexist, but I suspect it's ladies who've gone for pee and used some bog roll and left it, use the bog roll, but hey, put it in your pocket and take it away with you.
Words to live by, Heather, and absolutely, I mean, I know this is a touchy subject, but I think you've handled it with great sensitivity. Thank you so much for your time again.
No problem.
Heather, morning.
Tell you, Mark, I was passing a field, Charlie's Field, bottom of my road,
aye.
Absolutely full of dock leaves. And I thought, you know what, toilet roll shortage, is a whole cash crop there for Scotland's farmers. And presumably you could take the dock leaves on the hill.
Yeah, I am minded of the old Robbie Shepherd joke, you know, about the two wee boys, brothers, that turn up late for the squeal one morning, and, you know, the dominie's giving them a hard time, and he says, an upset tummy, sir, I had to stop and go to the toilet. And he says, what about you, have you got an upset tummy too? He says, no, sir, I was pooing the dockings. You've got to do it. There's a link to the Mountaineering Scotland information about hygiene in the outdoors on our website. Now, complete change of pace and location. We're going to take you to the rainforests of West Africa now. Our Scotland Outdoors Midweek podcast this week is an interview with a very old friend of mine, Sally Ann Wilson, who spent a considerable amount of time in that part of the world making wildlife films.
Yeah, Sally Ann was telling us about filming chimps who were hunting monkeys for David Attenborough's Trials of Life series. And she went on to describe an unforgettable encounter with a leopard.
I could have been breakfast. Sometimes, you know, being the producer, you're I think, basically a pack horse. And so you don't always get to see the good bits, but you're very often there trailing in and out and carrying the kit. And on this occasion, I was carrying the kit in to where the chimpanzees had nested the night before, and then I had to walk back before dawn, before they were up. The cameraman had to be there, Mike Richards, and then I had to walk back quite a long way to where I'd left the vehicle down a forest track. And I used to leave the side lights on just for the time I was walking off so that I could find it again, and I had a head torch. And I'd heard the birds as I walked in, just sort of mobbing and thinking, oh, it must be a snake around there. The rest of the forest birds are making an unusual sound. And you become incredibly attuned to sounds. I mean, I think one of the things, if you've worked deep in rainforest, as I did for many years in both Africa and in Asian rainforests, you become, your animal side really comes out. It's one of the things I love. You become that raw instincts of, your sight is sharp, your hearing is really acute, you're aware of everything you touch. And for me, the most incredible thing is the smell. So this morning I was sort of plodding along and thinking, oh, yeah, it's all sounding a bit, but nothing else seemed unusual. And I stopped because I thought, oh, there are the two side lights of the vehicle further down the track. And as I paused to see these two lights far off, I realised that they weren't the headlights of the track at a distance, of the van at a distance. They were the eyes of a young leopard who was standing just a few feet in front of me on the side of the track with his feet up, paws up on a log, looking down at me. And then time did absolutely freeze as I felt his roar. I didn't hear his roar. I felt his roar that... The only thing I can think of is similar is if you're somewhere with a metro system or an underground beneath you, it came up through the pavement, you know, it came up through the ground, through my heels and just shuddered up my spine. And I'd always been told, you know, we're always prepared for what we should do in these circumstances. We knew there were a lot of leopards in the forest. that you stand still, you do not run. But at that point, my head torch went out, probably just fear. And I turned and I ran so fast. And I think it was very lucky that obviously he'd had breakfast or didn't like the look of me and that was it. But we watched him and his sister on mornings later on in exactly the same place playing. And he was big and he was big, but just so beautiful. And they used to sort of roll and tumble and we used to have to just wait for them to finish their games before we could drive past them. But yeah, very lucky escape, I think. One of my nine lives.
That whole rainforest thing, I mean, I get the impression you love it. I've only worked on it a few times. We were going to find a new species of thrush in Indonesia, and we got sent in, said it might take you 3 days, it might take you 3 months. Don't come back till you've got the programme. And we put mist nets up, and we're camping every night, and the sound of the bamboo clicking away every night in the wind. And I could see the sky through the canopy, and honestly, it was like being at the bottom of the sea. It drove me insane. And after 2 weeks, I actually walked out in a straight line till I came to the edge of the rainforest, drank it in for an hour, and then walked straight back in again. It just really disturbed me, but you love it.
I guess it can be very claustrophobic. It's not what a lot of people think it is. It is dark, it is sweaty, it is itchy. You get a lot of leeches and itchy bits. You cover right up to stop all these things. And there are some animals that I'm wary of. I'm wary of snakes. I'm not phobic about them, but I'm thoughtful, particularly when you're in the forest, that the way you put your foot on the floor so that they feel the vibrations, which is how they operate. And you know, nothing's going to hurt you unless you threaten it. Even talking about it to both of you, it just takes me back and to some magical, magical times. I mean, I grew up in Sussex with glowworms. You know, we rarely see glowworms anymore. But I remember then being in my early 20s in a very, very ancient rainforest in Malaysia one night and going out, much like you, and going out looking for ground nesting pitters, which are little birds that hop along the floor. And we were going out with lamps and just seeing what else we could see at night. And suddenly there were fireflies. And this took me back to the glowworms. And it was a sort of a blue light and this wonderful sounding forest. And these little fireflies, it was like being in a Disney movie. You know, all around
and you,
there
the
was Tinkerbell, you know. oh no. But those sort of things, I am so privileged to have had those experiences, you know, especially where we are now, where travel looks as if it won't be the same again, at least for a while. And, you know, my life has been just wonderful in that I've seen so many things in the natural world that really remind me of just, you know, how lucky we are to share this planet.
Our midweek podcast guest, Sally-Ann Wilson, and you find all editions of the Scotland Outdoors podcast on BBC Sounds and also within the Out of Doors section on the BBC Radio Scotland website. Just look for podcasts. Is that rain I'm hearing at your end?
Yeah, it's suddenly started bucketing down now. The thunder's gone away. The sky is certainly lightening up to the south, but it's been quite a morning so far. Yeah. But if you're in the trees, go to the BBC Sounds and find the latest edition of Travelling Quote with Bruce McGregor on BBC Radio Scotland. On Thursday, Bruce had a lockdown session with Hamish Napier, and he's just released his album, The Woods Inspired by Trees of Strathspey. And remember, we had Hamish on the programme at the start of the year. Great listen.
Yeah. No, very, very good communicator. We're getting complaints in about our use of poo. Apparently it's creeping anglicisation, is it? We should use a Scottish word. We've been discussing this, and our options are limited, it has to be said, at this time of the morning on the BBC, but we decided jobby is probably the best one to go for. Now on to our mystery bird. In a slight break from tradition, it's Touchy, he said, changing the subject incredibly quickly. Time to reveal the mystery bird. Correct answers from Keith and Blair Gowrie, Dave in the Borders, Ranald and Bigger, Ian in Kintore, Sarah in Annan, and Willie the Farmer in Brechin. And to be honest, dozens more that frankly we haven't got the time to read out, and we apologise for that.
A lot of people said it was a jay, which is quite spooky because I was going to do a jay, mm-hmm. and I thought it would be too hard, so I went for the heron, which was slightly easier, and fooled absolutely nobody. Loads of folk get it right. Here's a bit more about the heron.
The heron is a strange bird. There's nothing else like it in the Scottish countryside. Long legs, distinctive razor-like bill, a tuft of black crest, grey wings, and a long neck, white as any swan. And that call, it's harsh. And if you're walking in a wood in the evening darkness, it's somewhat frightening. The grey heron is a magnificent bird and a serious predator. At home in fresh water, by the shoreline, and a dreaded visitor for anyone with a garden pond. And they're patient, standing in the one spot for long periods, till finally the long coiled neck is unleashed and a frog or a fish is thrown to the bank where it's dispatched with a knife-like beak. But it's not just frogs or fish that will attract the heron. Rats and even stoats are always on the menu. Killed, dipped in water to soak the fur to make it easier to digest, and then head first down the gullet to go with the lay of the fur. They can then be seen standing in a field, quietly digesting the prey. The call of a single heron is unnerving, but at breeding time, the noise at a heronry can be deafening. And of course, there's folklore. The ability of the heron to fish wasn't ignored by superstitious anglers, and they thought the bird's legs somehow attracted the fish. And many an angler carried a heron's foot in his pocket for luck, and some took it even further, coating the line in heron fat. A disgusting mixture made by boiling heron claws. Which made sense to use all of the bird, because in medieval times they were considered a delicacy and the property of the crown. And when George Neville became Archbishop of York in 1465, 400 herons were served to the guests. But finally, with royal protection, came punishment for non-royals, cheeky enough to have a roast heron or two. Heavy, heavy fines for poaching, and in Scotland, the penalty was the severing of your right hand.
It is a prehistoric bird, a heron. You know, you see these great, you know, creaking wing beats. You know, the fact that the neck kind of doubles in. It does kind of look a bit like a pterodactyl.
It very much does so, but it's the thought of boiling up all those heron feet to make the fat to put on the angler's line.
Yeah.
Goodness knows what that smelled like.
Let's not go there. Speaking of which, let's not go there. The great poo, jobby, whatever debate.
No,
continue. Well,
no,
I know, but listen, I'm merely the messenger. I don't come up with this stuff.
Yeah, but it's your career I'm thinking about.
No, exactly. Somebody's saying jobby is a juvenile word. See, folk are so fussy at the moment. Jobby's a juvenile word, so we should go for keek instead. But see, I think keek is a noun. It's not, you know, two keek, I don't know. Is it a verb?
Move on.
Well, I'm just saying. All right, let's move to Tin Huts. Tin Huts. Paul in Forgandenny says, first time I've written, but I've been listening for a long time and love the show. The sense of relief from Banff. I spent a week over several summers at Cultibraggan Camp near Comrie for cadet camp, an old POW camp. Some great memories and stories.
Oh, yeah.
The camp buildings, all corrugated iron Nissen huts. The officer's mess was great, and each hut had a pot belly stove, which everyone had in dip for wood before the CO said we could actually light them. Alan says, lovely morning here in Stirling. It's actually a lovely morning here in Aberdeen now too. My first encounter with corrugated iron was when I was 5. Used a sheet as a slide from the cable end of the house. I turned over on the way down and sliced open the inside of my left knee on the edge of the sheet. Dr. Smith used 5 stitches to pull the wound together. I am 70 and the scar is still visible, including the stitch holes. And returning briefly and apologetically to, you know, the jobby word, Colin Mary Abercrombie and Finn, the border collie, who's blameless in this regard, by the way, says, we have helped with an annual tied up in Ben Nevis several times. It never ceases to amaze us where people will go to the toilet in Ben Nevis. There's a large boulder at roughly halfway where many people stop for a bite to eat. If you look behind the boulder, you will realise why local guides call it Jobby Rock. Right, OK. You're strangely quiet on the subject, Mr. McElrath. Now we know what...
Yeah, well, we give away what the mystery bird was. What about that mystery insect that Craig McAdam from Bugloith provided? Tell us what you think this is.
I haven't a Scooby-Doo. I genuinely don't know what that is.
No. I don't think anybody will get that either. If you do know, well, hats off.
This is the end of Picnic Week, as we said earlier. There is such a thing as National Picnic Week. Back in 2017, we thought it a bit of a wheeze to have an out-of-doors picnic. We plumped in Colliston, because it's one of my favourite places in the world. It's a wee coastal village just north of Aberdeen. Perhaps our timing of late September was a bit thick, and we were proved right, as it turned out to be, well, predictably, a dank and drizzly day.
Yeah, however, we were undeterred and started to lay out our respective spreads. Very soon became apparent that my definition of a picnic was somewhat different from Mark's.
My original intention was to have a sort of like a beach picnic, the kind of thing that I used to enjoy as a child, you know, with proper Scottish food. You know, tea cakes and cremola foam and things, and sausages.
Burnt
and
sausages.
Beans. Burnt sausages. They can't be properly cooked, they must be burnt.
Well, especially if you start with frozen sausages.
Well, that's a minor point. But, you said, all right, I'd rather do a different type of picnic, and you've gone completely nuts.
Well, no, this is just how I'd normally start a morning. We've got whole Scottish langoustines, which are cold at the moment, I've boiled them up. We've got butterfly langoustines done with Thai spices and olive oil. A couple of scallops for everybody, some hot smoked salmon. And I got up this morning, baked some bread. We got tomato and basil focaccia. And a plat with a bit of turmeric in it, just to add a bit of excitement. Some Scottish smoked salmon, mayonnaise. I see you've got the tomato ketchup and some Scottish butter. We are opposite ends of the culinary scale here.
How did you actually find the time to get out of your silk pyjamas and feed the peacocks and sweep up the tennis courts and make all that at the same time?
Well, the butler did the rest. Yeah. Apprehensive about how you're going to cook the frozen sausages. Obviously, you've done this before.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you having for starters?
What am I having for starters? I think I'll probably go for the chicken paste sandwich.
Excellent.
Chicken paste sandwich or... Yeah, no, chicken paste sandwich, and then it'll be either a sausage butty or a bacon butty for mains, and for desserts, I've got custard creams.
Okay. I've got a wee bit of a starter just now. I don't know, did you want any?
Well, what have you got?
We've got the bread, obviously. Mm-hmm. Help yourself.
That's the turmeric.
This is the turmeric.
Flat.
This is tear and share.
Is it?
And a bit of smoked salmon. And,
look at that.
And some olives. This is a butterfly langoustine.
Hopefully it's done. I really want to say it's horrible. I really do, but it's fantastic.
I'm sure my burnt sausages will be better, but this is delicious.
It's just a different thing, isn't it? That's quite pleasing, isn't
it? Mm. What is the spice in that?
It's a bit of Thai spice and black pepper and olive oil and a wee hint of garlic.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. McElrath.
Yep. You got any space in there, yeah?
What do you want?
I want that.
All right, fair enough.
There's a black pudding to go with the scallops. Speyside black pudding.
Yep.
I know it's a bit of a cliche having the black pudding with the scallops, but I'm really finding black pudding goes well with almost everything.
Yeah.
It's great.
I do like black pudding.
See, it's lovely. And I'm quite looking forward to your sausages now as well. But it's just eating outside, isn't it?
Don't patronise me, McElrath.
I'm not patronising you. I'm trying to inspire you to great things.
No, yeah, well, I've gone for shop-bought sausages, pork and apple, admittedly. Now, if you actually marinate them in burnt butter like this on an open fire and then sprinkle them with sand, you get the authentic taste of Scotland. That's what a beach picnic's supposed to be, pal. None of your fancy
but
pants.
It doesn't matter. If you served that up
at
a dinner party, you would have a kind of stunned silence and suddenly we have to get back for the babysitter.
I've had that.
But on the beach, it doesn't matter. You're outside. You kind of, it's much more forgiving and it tastes better.
But there must be a reason for that, because food definitely does taste better outside. And I have no idea why that happens. It doesn't matter what. And it's not to do with physical exercise either, because other than dragging the stuff out of the car and bringing it down here on the beach, we've done nothing. But it still tastes much better.
One of the things that you actually brought today is hot smoked salmon.
Oh, that's lovely. That you twist nice. A lemon on that. What?
Listen, I thought I was doing well bringing the ketchup. But no. Anyway.
Well, you can't have it without lemon. See, much as I love prawns, not a huge fan of lobster, hot smoked salmon is just one of the best things in the world.
It's a shame that you have to have lobster at this time of the day, isn't it? It's kind of de rigueur.
It's almost ready, so we'll see what it's like.
What's wrong with my sausages?
Well, I was a bit worried about my black pudding.
Aye.
It was looking a bit. But I've run out of barbecue power. So I'm going to take
we need to put more wood in this.
Get my scallops
yeah.
and cook them in the black pudding mm-hmm. and sausage fat, because I think that's going to be
that's your actual job,
fantastic.
Isn't it?
Fantastic. But yeah.
You've got the black pudding.
We've got some lobster here.
This is lobster.
It might be slightly overdone.
Ah, that's a beautiful meat, actually. It's quite a sweet meat.
It's not quite as sweet as a langoustine, but...
No, I actually prefer that.
See, you do have expensive tastes.
I do have expensive tastes. Right, well, this is it. It's always been my problem. We'll get round to eating some of those sausages shortly, because I know they went in slightly frozen, but they must be cooked by now. Oh, look at this. You've got the scallop shells, you've got the scallops, you've got a wee bit of black pudding, and better still, my sausages are now properly burnt. That's the important thing.
Right, well, I'm going to try a bit of scallop first, and then I'll look at further your sausages. They look fantastic.
Yeah.
Go. It's a bit hot.
I don't think you can really fully enjoy a sausage sarnie out in the great outdoors without brown sauce, and thankfully I had the presence of mind to bring some. So although you're posh and I'm plebeian this week, I think it's working.
Well, I'm going to try your sausages, obviously.
Yeah. Do you want some ketchup?
No, I'm going to try some mayonnaise with a hint of paprika on the top.
On sausages?
Yeah. It's perfect.
You're scaring me now.
Right.
Okay. Anyway.
I'm surprised they're not burnt. Really surprised.
Bearing in mind how absolutely awful the morning was in terms of rain, this has actually been exceptionally pleasant, and it just goes to show that even on a day that isn't bright sunshine and it is overcast, you can have fun and have a nice time and have a nice meal. You know, it's just a nice place to be, Colliston. It's a lovely place to be, Colliston, and the pleasures of outdoor dining. I think I fairly clearly showed the difference between you and I, you know, when it comes to sort of culinary stuff, Ewan.
Well, yeah, it was when you pulled out the baked beans. I thought, oh no, I draw the line at that. It's a step too far.
I love sausages and baked beans. Joining us on the line now is someone who I imagine is nearer the UN end of the culinary scale than mine, Claire Jessamine, the food equine, food writer and blogger. You were listening to that, Claire. Now, frankly, have you any sympathy at all for my position?
Do you know what? I kind of fall in between both of you. I think those were two pretty extremes. So I think there's definitely a happy medium in there somewhere.
Possibly.
you both obviously think you're correct.
Yeah, but picnics don't have to be the soggy sandwiches, and we've been banging on all morning about Scotch eggs. Mark doesn't like them. But you can do so much on a picnic.
Oh, totally. I mean, it doesn't have to be. I mean, I was kind of thinking back to picnics as a child, and it was my granny used to take us, and we used to go to Munlochy Bay, and we used to kind of wade through squelchy, muddy bits and tartan travel rug out, and we'd have the tartan thermos as well. Hard-boiled eggs, the only thing I really remember. We must have had sandwiches and something else as well, but I vividly remember tartan travel rug, hard-boiled eggs. But my aunt, she had the ultimate picnic accessory, which I always coveted. One of the, you know, the big proper picnic wicker basket, and it did the big creak as it went up, and all the plates were fixed in with the little leather straps and the poppers, and that was kind of the posh picnic end.
See,
of the scale.
That's so astonishing. You mentioned that, Claire, because Jan Finlayson's been in contact. Say, my parents had a picnic set, which I think dated from the 1950s. It had two flasks, two boxes for food, china cups and saucers, china plates, a sugar container, one knife and fork, and four teaspoons. It came in red and white with a Dots case.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I did actually. I did probably inspired by those childhood memories. When I got married, I put a proper wicker basket picnic set on my wedding list. I have to say, I'm not sure if I've used it all that much. It tends to be more, I don't know, I mean, I guess there's a difference between if you have sort of a planned picnic and you're like, right, we're going for a picnic, we'll get packed, we'll prepare this, that, and the next thing. Or if it's just kind of, oh, it's a really sunny day, we're just going to throw a few things in the cool bag and go out and see where it takes us. So I think there can be different kinds of picnics. And as you guys discovered, it's all about the setting and the company.
Yes.
Yeah. But there is something about that wicker basket, that noise. I've got one as well.
Of course you do.
And having it off real china. But there's a kind of trend for ready-made picnics now.
Yeah, well, there seems to be a lot. Obviously, we're in slightly strange times at the moment. So I think we're all looking for something a bit different than having to cook for ourselves. So there's a lot of places doing sort of platters and ready-made picnics and that kind of thing. So you can kind of have the whole picnic vibe without the hassle, and you can, I guess, again, if it is thunder and lightning, such as is today, you can just set it up and have it in your living room, and hopefully no minimal sand, minimal midges in the living room, which is always a kind of bugbear on a Scottish picnic.
I would like to make the case for outdoor dining as an aid to creativity. Because when I worked down in Glasgow, the old building, the BBC, Queen Margaret Drive, used to be just across the road from Botanic Gardens. And I would say about once a month during the summertime, we would decide to have one of our meetings actually in the Botanic Gardens. And we'd all buy stuff from the supermarkets and things like that. And we would have a picnic. And it was 10 times more creative than anything we actually did inside the building.
Did you bring your teddy bears along?
Never thought of that. Never thought. Oh, I wish I had now.
Oh, I'm a bit disappointed in you.
But I'm disappointed in me too.
But there's something about eating outside that makes it such a wonderful experience. Remember Mark and I on Harris, eating seaweed on the beach in the morning, and it was just a wonderful experience.
I know, I was, because I was kind of thinking about memorable picnics, and apart from sort of the childhood ones, probably the most memorable one recently, and it was, again, it was September, which, okay, sometimes we can get a good September, but up in Orkney was on Scale Beach, which, lots of pebbles, so we'd kind of find big flat stones to sit on, but it's Scale Beach, looking out, beautiful, just along the road from Scarabrae's, we had all the local Orkney produce, were sat there eating oatcakes and cheese and fish, and it was just, I guess it's a sort of sense of place and being a bit kind of posh about it, but it is, it's eating food from that area, in the area, with people. Can have a wee local beer or a local dram as well, perhaps, if you're not driving. I guess a picnic can be anything from something really elaborate, but if you're hiking up to the top of a hill, you're really not wanting to drag the huge wicker basket and a bottle of champagne and so on. But
I'm sorry, you just put me in mind donkeys years ago of going up the Coolans with my brother-in-law. And we got to the top of the hill, it was blabbing, and it was a blistering hot day, and it's like boilerplate and blabbing, so the sun was just bouncing straight off. And we were both puggled, you know, by the time we actually got to the top. And I said, how do you fancy a nice, cool tin of beer now? And he says, don't tell me you've carried two tins of beer up here. And I said, no, I haven't. I'd stuck them in his rucksack earlier.
Oh.
But now, Claire, we'll get you to organise a picnic for us once this lockdown business is over. Thank you very much
indeed,
for joining us.
Indeed.
We shall look forward to it.
I will likewise. I'll make sure I put the beer in your rucksack.
Good man. All right. There's a link to Claire's blog on our website too. Now, we teased you earlier with a snippet of my homage to the Scotch egg. Here it is in its entirety. Comic and vain. We are aware for the fact that folk in care homes, life's been very much restricted in the last few months. But here, I'm going to be harking back to the halcyon days, which I hope we will return to in the near future. The old folks' home was a wrecked. But life was awfully droll. And the matron of the Hale shebang was mair nor Jock could thole. She was a nippet little crater, her life one long parade, as the heed and funer member of the Anti-Fun Brigade. Every year midsummer they got teen out to the park,
to hay an old folks' picnic. Well, you can stuff that for a lark. For all you'd get was sandwiches, a fine piece and some tea. Nae chance o' a tin of lager, or a dram, or two, or three. For the matron was teetotal, a brethren quine fae Bucky. And as she nae langer bite there, then was nae Bucky lucky. She had nae truck wi' alcohol, strang drink like beer or whisky. But Jock would get refresh it yet, though his ploy was surely risky. The nicht afore the picnic, Jock had got his plans half figured, to sabotage the enterprise and see the whole thing jiggered. He'd use a bitty subterfuge to liven up the shower, aye, subterfuge and picnic food, and cask strength Aberlour. He'd got the swap of an owl syringe for a half-pound bag of sweeties, for an old soul cry at Mary Ann for type 1 diabetes. Now he crept into the kitchen like a commando on a bridge and tiptoed across the lino and opened up the fridge. Aye, there they were, just like last year, and for many years afore, a tray of orange ballys aneath the ice tray door. They were matron's contribution, supposed to be a treat, a biled egg and breadcrumbs and some Guy Tuch sausage meat. Jock just didn't like them. In fact, it was more like hate. They clogged up his dentures and got stuck aneath his plate. Matron Kent, he didn't like them, and frankly, didn't care. She'd stand and watch him finish in, and then come back with mare, the old witch. Time and again, he felt the syringe. He kept a careful tally and scooshed a double whisky into every orange bally. If Matron Ergeloosed his plan, she'd fairly hit the roof, for every yin of her picnic treats was now o'er 70 proof. The following morn they headed out, a weary band of sodgers, a crocodile of zimmers, over 20 coffin dodgers. They found a fine spot on the grass and gradually settled down and sat in resignation while the scran was handed roon. The sandwiches, well, fit can you say, were much mere breed than fillin'. They'd obviously warmed the juice up while the pot of tea was chillin'. The Empire biscuits had gone as soft. The cake was like asbestos. But matron's treats, they are concurred, were totally stupendous. The reen went wide. They sat up straight. They said, oh, these things are rare. And matron was dumbfoonert when they are cried out for mare. The eens with teeth, they champ it down, while she just stood and look it. Files the toothless eens amongst them just gummed her bars and sook it. Now, nobody's sure if it happened next. The police report was sparse, but the annual Aldine's picnic fairly turned into a farce. They were swimming in the fountain, they were fechting in the dubs, and one couple in their 90s headed off into the shrubs. A big fat dame cried teeny, who manifestly wasnae, showed dimpled knees and a wild strip tease, and let's be fair, far hisnae. She scandalised the matron, took the wind clean out her sails, by using paper hankies to do a dance of the seven veils. They are agreed, as far as picnics went, it really was the tops, that the best of the entertainment had been fechting with the cops. And fu' matron had been arrested, carted off down till the station, for trying to poison all folks, chemical intoxication. That night they sat contented in the day room of the hame, to review the day's proceedings and rejoice in matron's shame. Jock's pal Tam asked, fit ye cry those orange ballies? Aye, they fair gied her a fleg. And old Jock smiled and murmured, oh, they cry those things, scotched eggs.
Scotched eggs with a twist, and who knows, that could take off, injected with cast strength at Aberlour. What goes on in your head?
I don't know. It worries me sometimes too. Doesn't matter. Craig McAdam from charity Bug Life was on the programme defending the midgie earlier in the programme, but he also very kindly left us with a mystery insect sound. Here it is again. Now, I have to say, I hadn't a Scooby-Doo about this, and still don't have a Scooby-Doo about this. Sarah and Selkirk says, is it a Death Watch beetle? Mae Frame says, Death Watch beetle. Vera Fraser, Finstown and Orkney says, woodworms. Karen and Elgin says, is it a Kappa Kaylee? No, we said it was an insect. Alan in Edinburgh says, it's a grasshopper. So, we've got Craig back on the line now. What actually is it?
So, it's a stonefly, a pair of stoneflies drumming to find a mate. So these are aquatic insects. When they come out of the water, they need to find a mate. And what they do is they vibrate their abdomen on a hard surface, and then the male will do that, then the female will respond, and they'll gradually find each other on the bankside.
What's a stonefly? What does it look like?
So they're under the water, they're sort of like pretty chunky nymphs. And when they come out of the water, they're a flat insect with the wings flattened across the back of their body, and they crawl about on the bankside. This particular one is the biggest one we've got, which is about 30 millimetres in length.
So that sound was actually recorded under the water, was it?
No, that's recorded out. That's the adult, okay. And that was recorded on the. Well, it was put into a little paper tray, and then it vibrates on the tray and we can record it.
See, you learn all sorts of useful stuff on this. Craig, we must get you back to actually get more insect sounds out of you at some stage, because there's obviously a rich world that we know little of.
Yeah, that'd be fine. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, again, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Craig McAdam from Bugs Life. Much obliged.
It's been a very different mixed bag. It's a strange programme at the best of weeks, but my goodness me, what an eclectic mix.
We started off earlier in the programme talking about corrugated iron buildings. Patton Kinkoff says, I'm just remembering the corrugated roof of my house in Adelaide. Very noisy in those tropical thunderstorms, not to mention the giant-sized hailstones. An opossum lived in the roof space. Happy days. I wouldn't miss your programme, the highlight of my radio listening week. Thank you. Well, thank you, Pat. Alexander Hay, it's hello again. The conductor, Sir Thomas Beecham, was no fan of the harpsichord and described its sound as being like that of two skeletons dancing, I'm saying here, on a corrugated iron roof in a hailstorm. Thanks for your uplifting show with the poo and all that. Christine McKenzie says, picnics here. Best picnic memories from 10 years ago, maybe in around March. My partner and I walked up a hill near Inverary and enjoyed our homemade sandwiches, Christmas cake and coffee from our flasks while sitting under a tree and watching enormous snowflakes descend silently. It was like picnicking in Narnia. What an absolutely lovely image that is. I can really see that.
Yeah, and the good news is we started with hail and thunder and lightning, and it is now blue sky. It's going to be okay.
You never know, never know. Derek and Liz Young, Balmullo and Fife says, year later, I put up a new garden shed and decided to use a galvanised tin roof instead of tarred felting that just degenerates every few years. So much fun to put up the pre-cut sheets with special sharp bolts and a posh ridge like Adult Meccano. I did that on our stables as well, Derek and Liz. And that was it. Again, we were absolutely packed to the gunnels, and we didn't get a chance to read out all the comments, texts, emails, etc., because there's just such a volume of stuff coming in at the moment. Thank you very much if you did get in contact. Please don't stop just because you didn't get on air this time. We do our level best to shoehorn in as much as we can, and it's very much appreciated. If you've got time and you like this podcast, please take the time to like us or rate us. Apparently, it just means other people might get a chance of finding us or directly refer us to a friend. If you enjoyed it, they might enjoy it. You never know. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.